We get the hour underway, though, by welcoming back to the program an acclaimed filmmaker who's been telling the story of America for more than four decades through films like The Civil War, jazz, baseball, and country music. His new one, a little different as it gets outside the United States and talks about the great and talented Leonardo da Vinci. It comes to PBS on November 18th, and here on Downtown to tell us all about it is Ken Burns. Well, Ken, I know much has been made about this being your first film outside the confines of the United States. Is it safe to say that it took some efforts from both your daughter, Sarah Burns, your son-in-law, David McMahon, and the historian, Walter Isaacson, to swing you in this direction?
Well, it's Walter's fault in one way, but it's Sarah and Dave's impetus. Walter and I have been friends for a long time. I was making a film several years ago, Benjamin Franklin. He and I were having dinner, and he spent most of the dinner trying to persuade me to also do Leonardo da Vinci. I had a full lineup of films that extended to 2030. I didn't know how that would happen. And after the dinner, I was remarking to Sarah and Dave that I was sort of like perturbed that he kept pushing. And they said, oh, that's a great idea. Let's do it. So we were in the throes then of making a film on Muhammad Ali together, and had just done one on Jackie Robinson, and before that one on the Central Park Five. And so Sarah and Dave picked up with two of my oldest grandchildren and went to Florence for a year between the summer of 22 and the summer of 23. And just there, they wrote the script, did the research, wrote the script, and we all three directed it and produced it along with Tim McAleer. And so it's very much them. And I think it's, to me, what's less important is this is a non-American subject. This is just one of the great human beings who's ever lived, and it transcends borders and countries and time. He feels incredibly modern. But I think that this is a new visual grammar for us. And all of that is all, you know, kudos to Sarah and Dave for pushing the envelope of how you're going to make a person who lived in the last half of the 15th and the early part of the 16th century come alive. And it was exhilarating for an old dog to learn some new tricks in this. And a lot of it has to do with split screens and use of modern footage in the midst of what we'll, where our audience will see as a traditional biography that would recognize it as our style. And so it gives it a kind of exhilarating lift to things. The amazing thing is that the soundtrack that I think David more than anyone else championed, which had a lot of different composers, and Caroline Shaw at one point very late in the process said, I want it just to be Caroline Shaw. And so she agreed to do the composition. And so the music, the soundtrack, is the first one that we've really had truly scored. And it is, I think, spectacular. She's someone who's interested not just in traditional musical instrumentation, but percussion and vocal work. And so this is, you know, an amazing, amazing soundtrack that takes this amazing, amazing human being and lifts him up even further, or makes him more accessible to us now in very direct, emotional ways. Because music is, of course, the only art form that's invisible, and it works on you faster than any other art form. And I think, and I, if Leonardo were around, I think he'd agree with me that all art forms aspire to mean music at the end of the day.
And the score is wonderful, and those split screens are so effective. And the use of Leonardo's notes and his illustrations make it so powerful and bring it to life.
Oh, I'm so glad you like it. It's very, very important. You know, we don't know much about him biographically. The TikTok of his life, the tabloid stuff, all of that is mostly lost, because you can find some grocery lists and you can find mentions of the expenses for his mom's funeral, and then everything else is sort of thousands and thousands of pages never published in his lifetime. Treatises on painting, on water dynamics, on the flight of birds, on aerodynamics, on dissections and anatomies that are in some cases 500 years ahead of their time. I mean, it was literally 435 years after he had figured out how heart valves worked, using silk and hearts of a calf, and also from human dissections and water filled with grass. He learned how things were pumped in the blood. MRIs confirmed it, but it took us until MRIs to find out what Leonardo knew with only his eye, no microscope, no telescope. It's just a phenomenal achievement, and of course, he is arguably the greatest painter who ever lived, with fewer than 20 paintings, and fewer than half of them are complete. And yet, the most famous painting in the world is his, and he is also the greatest scientist of his age, dealing with issues of gravity well before Galileo and Newton and Einstein. It's a wonder to behold, a curiosity. Kenneth Clark said he was the most curious man on earth. And I believe it, and that makes him utterly modern for us. And if he's got to be in the conversation among the top three or four, I mean, who else would you say? Shakespeare, maybe, maybe Bach or Mozart, and Leonardo's right there. And arguably, because of that modernness and the inventions, the sort of sense of possibility, that he seems like he'd be alive today. And David McMahon said to me the other day when we were in conversation with somebody else that he thought that if he were alive today, he'd be a filmmaker. Because if you look at one of his most celebrated paintings, The Last Supper, which was extremely problematic because it was out of sight in a monastery, he was not capturing a frozen moment. He was capturing several moments.
What's interesting, too, we learn from this or are reminded that the line between art and science has always been an artificial one.
Right, and he's the first person to do that. We live out of commerce and out of convenience. We want to label things, right? This is hip-hop. This is country music. This is, folk. This is classical. And the musicians are listening to everything and incorporating everything. There are no borders. You don't need a passport to travel between them. And I think this binary assumption extends to somebody like Leonardo. And we fall guilty to it, too. I don't really know how to express to you and your audience anything other than listing all these things. He's a painter. He's a sculptor. He's a designer of shows. He's a polymath. He's interested in mathematics. He's an anatomist. He's a botanist. He's interested in, the brain. He knows about this and he knows about that. And we tend to categorize. But, the end of the day, the easiest thing maybe to say that you'll see the Mona Lisa as a great work of science, and you'll see some of his anatomies as great works of art. And while that's still a binary construction, he didn't see that. In order to paint the most famous painting on earth, he had to understand the fundamental questions of human existence and of the physical world, not just the extraordinary landscape behind her, but as some early rhapsodizer about his work of century after his death or decades after his death said, you can see the blood flowing through her veins and her heart pumping. And that's an achievement. He knew how the hair should be. He knew how the face and cheeks and lines should be. And so, people always say, well, what do you want people to take away? And I always go, nothing. We've worked on this for 10 years or we worked on this for 5 years or whatever it is, whatever you take, we've done the best job we can, you take away. I have two in this case, and it's really a new thing for me, and that's I want people to want to be like him. That is to say, to want to be more curious about the fundamental questions. Who am I? Why am I here? Where did I come from? What is my purpose? Where am I going to? Just elemental questions that he was constantly asking of himself and, more importantly, the world, in observation and experiments his entire life. And the other one is that I think after you see this film, you won't have to make a joke, the nervous titter about her smile. You will just have that rendered. You will get it, because in that smile is the mystery of human existence and all of the questions I just asked.
We're talking with Ken Burns on Downtown. Some of the biographical information that we learn, although it's sparse, is that he was illegitimate and because of that couldn't go to university. But I loved learning that he regarded that lack of formal education as one of his greatest strengths and assets.
Yeah, so this is the thing. I mean, it's more complicated than that. He is born out of wedlock, and that's not uncommon then as it is today. And he doesn't get to go to university. That's the penalty. And so he does not have early on the kind of book learning thrown into him. Nature is his first teacher, and it's the greatest teacher of all. And never surrenders nature for him. It never surrenders that pole position in terms of the scheme of things. Later on, he will approach scholarship in every way, shape, or form, attempting to learn Latin, attempting to understand the ancients, having conversations with Aristotle and Socrates and Archimedes and Galen, the physician, and all of these other classical things as the world had gone into the Dark Ages and then came out. And he not only began to be in conversation, in quotes, with them, but he began to challenge them. And so the received wisdom from the ancients wasn't always right, particularly with regard to the physical world. And he begins to make some pretty compelling assumptions. And it's to watch him go along is great, and you begin to go, phew. You know, I went to Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts in 1971. It's a new experimental school. It had started the year before. It's still experimenting. I urge everyone to send their children to Hampshire College because it was transformational and not transactional. And so it was my nature. You wouldn't be talking to me if I hadn't gone to Hampshire College. I wouldn't be doing what I've been doing for the last 50 years if I hadn't graduated from there 49 years ago. So it's that way with him, that when he, but only exponentially greater, when he made nature his classroom and his teacher, God, in essence, he just, his mind was liberated, and so he could become as great a thinker as Aristotle, and yet, you know, we don't have paintings of Aristotle, we don't have machines of Aristotle, we don't have designs of Aristotle, we don't have scientific breakthroughs of Aristotle, you know what I mean? We have great wisdom and understanding, and Leonardo had that, but we have all the rest of this stuff. And it's in the guy whose biography is, as you say, kind of sparse. And that's a wonderful thing, because rather than slipping into the TikTok and the tabloid, we get to see what he filled his life with, these profound questions. Adam Gottnick, the writer, says, you know, he's looking to crack the code of organic form. That sounds kind of highfalutin, but just think about that. Like, he wants to know what life is, period, full stop. And by God, I think he got there. I think the combination of his life's work and what he's left us in writings and drawings and sketches and the handful of paintings that he did do and the even fewer that he completed are one of the great gifts to all of humanity, and makes him entirely relevant and modern in a funny way, as much as he's very much part of the 15th century Florence and early 16th century.
I wrote down as I was watching something else that Adam Gopnik said, that he emancipated painters to go beyond being artisans to become what Adam called princes of the mind.
Yes. It's a really important thing. You think of painters now, particularly since the development of Impressionism and beyond, and Modernism and all sorts of things, Abstract Expressionism, as sort of these sort of gods, if you will, up there. And in fact, our second episode is called Painter God, because if you can get to what he got to in the Mona Lisa, as one of our consultants, Francesca Borgo, says, then you're a painter God, you know. Aspiring to that, we forget that they're sort of technicians before. They're craftspeople. They're artisans. And he is engaging every single aspect of this, not just the styles and techniques, the painting, of which he's wrote voluminously about. He's got an entire treatise on the nature of painting and what the painter's role is. But it becomes much more, not just to paint who they are, but to paint the intentions, as he said, of their mind. And then he goes further in order to, you have to understand anatomy, you have to understand nature, and you have to understand the micro and the macro. You have to understand this other things. And so he's pursuing all his life with this energy. I mean, it just, it's inspiriting just to think and talk about his legacy in that way.
The story of the creation of the Last Supper was so fascinating, and I found myself especially moved by the story behind and the creation of the Virgin of the Rocks.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm so glad you said that. I've seen this now how many times? You know, 100 times, and it never fails to make me cry. I mean, first of all, we have a Catholic priest, Monsignor Timothy Verdon, who is also a very well-respected art historian, describing this painting, which is, you know, a dime a dozen in Renaissance and before that medieval time, the Virgin Mary with her child. In this case, it's her with a baby Jesus and a baby John the Baptist, because the legend is John the Baptist is bringing the news of the future passion, and that she knows through all eternity what her role is, right? At the same time, the maternal instincts are to protect her son. So one of her hands is hooked over John the Baptist's shoulders, in essence trying to hold him back from moving towards her son to complete this prophecy. The son is oblivious to his mother's concern. He's already accepted what his role is, and he's blessing with his two fingers up John the Baptist. Her left hand is trying to reach down to her son, and God has put an angel in the way. Yeah. And so when you take this scene, which is very familiar in all the Renaissance, and then all of a sudden you've got this dynamic to it that is not only the spiritual dynamic, but the human dynamic, the maternal instincts of a woman who knows her son must be sacrificed, but also has that protective feeling. And my God, you know, when you're able to do two things at once like that in a painting, it's so beautiful too, the background and the expression on Mary's face, the calm in Jesus, the curiosity in John the Baptist, and the sort of grace and presence of the angel. It's just like, oh my God, no one had ever painted anything like that before. You know, nothing like that had ever happened in the history of painting. And you're going, and this guy get it.
We also see a very human side of Da Vinci when he experienced what's called a crisis of confidence watching Michelangelo create his David.
Well, you know, it's very funny. He's like everybody else. You know, Michelangelo is this very difficult, you know, bombastic, arrogant, the exact opposite of Leonardo, who we know to be gregarious and popular and funny and witty, and as one of his biographers says, a work of art before he even began a work of art. He sees this guy come in and plop his David down in the middle of Florence, and there's a committee to determine where it's going to go, and he says, oh, let's put it behind that low wall there.
Right.
They go, no, we're putting it out front. And then he wrote a little bit about how you got to get the muscles right, because if you don't get the muscles right in anatomy, and he studied under a painter, Verrocchio, who was also a sculptor, so he knew a great deal about sculpture, then the muscles look like a bag of walnuts. And so what you see is a little bit of professional jealousy. It sort of passes, and he doesn't, he boasts, at various times, he's plunged into a very dynamic and in some cases competitive art scene, and he reacts to it in different ways, sometimes indifferently, sometimes with the kind of concern that the competition or the appearance of things will overshadow, and then other times you can have a petty response like that one. It makes him human, and to me, I feel like we got to know him, or at least got inside his mind and that restless curiosity that is so infectious.
Why do you think, Ken, that so many of his later works remained unfinished?
Well, it's not just later works, it's early ones too. I think he's solving problems. You know, he's got a bigger fish to fry than whatever the job is in the present. I have come across someone who's vaguely like this. I made a film almost 30 years ago on Frank Lloyd Wright. And Frank Lloyd Wright was always pushing materials to do something, and the clients were calling up and saying, you know, the rain is coming down on my desk. And he says, move your desk. You know, he's got that sort of, I think that he doesn't have that arrogance that Frank Lloyd Wright had, but he's got 10 times the genius of Frank Lloyd Wright, who is the greatest American architect. And he's got this sense of that each thing that he's doing is a set of questions. And when somehow he's either solved the questions or they're unsolvable, he just moves away. Well, you know, really, really great. The Adoration of the Magi is one of the greatest unfinished works that he ever did. It's the first, many people said in the film, the first experimental work of art in Western art. It's just still an amazing painting being unfinished. And I think it's just the questions that he's asking are bigger than anything that he did. And so he's always a disappointment, or often a disappointment to the clients that have commissioned things. He does not deliver the portrait of this 22-year-old wife of a silk merchant named Gioconda in Florence, and he just carries the painting for the rest of his life with him. And when he's finally hired by the French king to be his Aristotle, to his fanciful thinking about himself that he's Alexander, he brings the painting along, and when some folks visit from Rome, he scrolls out his notebooks, an infinity of volumes, somebody comments, thousands and thousands of pages of his notebooks, and he shows a few paintings, and one of them included this portrait, not delivered, of this wife of a person, which the Europeans call the Gioconda, and we call the Mona Lisa.
The film discusses his sexuality, but it's not the centerpiece of the film, and a large part of that is because attitudes and acceptance of homosexuality were very different in that place and time.
Well, I won't say they're different. There's acceptance now, and there's unacceptance now. There was unacceptance then, and there was acceptance then. And so I think what you have is, you know, Ecclesiastes, which is the Old Testament, said, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun, suggesting that human nature doesn't change. And so reactions to homosexuality, which he probably most certainly was gay, are there then as they are now, and various ebbs and flows of that. Artists often have, and I think Leonardo enjoyed it a little bit later on, a kind of complete acceptance of whatever he was, whoever he was, in a way that some people in some professions remain closeted or are persecuted. It's just, as you say, it's just a fact. And it's interesting insofar as it's a bit of biographical detail. But born out of wedlock and gay does not in itself say how this person became. And the more important search is our search for what he was searching, which are, as I said, these fundamental questions about life. Who am I? Where did I come from? What is my purpose here? Where am I going?
You get to know your subjects so well and bringing them to life for us. Was it difficult to say goodbye to Da Vinci?
You know what? I never will say goodbye. It's like a child, right? Maybe by finishing the film, they're going off to college, right? But they're still part of my life. My first film that was broadcast on PBS in 1982 on Brooklyn Bridge, I just walked over the Brooklyn Bridge this morning. Right? I took a picture of it. Right? I've seen that bridge in every time of day from every season, from every vantage point, and I still walk across it when I'm in New York two or three. This is the fourth time this week. And so you never leave these subjects. They never leave you. They add something to your life, and I am so profoundly grateful first to Walter Isaacson and then to my daughter Sarah Burns and her husband David McMahon for convincing me to get involved in this project, then for their genius in helping us figure out how to tell this complicated story, and then finally to getting to know him and his remarkable life, and I can't wait to share it with everyone else. You know, I used to joke that, well, he's kind of American because he's named after the patron saint of freedom, and a neighbor is Amerigo Vespucci, who's an Italian explorer, and the entire North and South American continents are named after the first name of his neighbor Vespucci. And so, you know, he must be an honorary American in some way, but I don't need to say that. What he is a human being, and an extraordinary human being who offers us insight into the most important things about our relatively short passage here. You know, he understood that this is all a big tragedy. None of us, not you, not me, not anyone listening, gets out of this alive. And so then the question is, now what? His life is a spectacular example of the now what, the answer to the now what.
Well, and I'm sure others will have the experience I had watching the film. I come out of it wanting to be more curious and wanting to be a yes. better person with a fuller life.
Yes, yes, that's it. That's it. That's what, you know, as I said, this is the first time I've ever had a wish list. You know, just don't make a joke again about Mona Lisa's smile after you've seen it. You don't need to. It's bigger than that. And want to be like him. Want to be like Leo, right? We want to have to be more curious, to ask more questions, to be more fully engaged in the present. Just think about it. He's a lefty. He writes backwards in a mirror script. Mm. Every time he writes a grocery list down, he's got to do, you know, three or four operations, you know, rubbing your tummy and patting your head is tough. This is like 10 times greater every time he wants to write the word the, you know, and you realize this is a life of intense focus, and that, you know, the great arrogance we in the present have of those who came before us is that we presume arrogantly that we know more than them. Leonardo's here to say, you got a long way to go.
It is a truly beautiful and inspiring film. Leonardo da Vinci comes to PBS November 18th and 19th. Ken, it is always a treat for us to get to talk with you. As always, thank you so much for making some time for us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Rich. I'm always happy. I'll always know that I finished the film because I'm talking to you.
Thanks again, Ken. Good luck as you continue to spread the good word about it. And I hope we'll catch up with you next year to discuss the American Revolution.
Yep, I'm finally seeing the light at the end of the tunnel on that one, and I cannot wait to share it.
Ken Burns with us here on Downtown, talking about Leonardo da Vinci again. It starts November 18th on public television, PBS.